You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, these days, if you want to send a message, you have all sorts of options. You've got mail, couriers, phone, email, fax. Go back to semaphore, smoke signals, if you'd like. But what if you want to send a message to an unknown civilization billions of miles away? What's the best way to get the message across? Radio signals? Laser light beams? Joining me now is Christopher Rose. He's professor of electrical and computer engineering and associate director of wireless network laboratories at Rutgers University in Piscataway, New Jersey. He's also co-author of a paper out this week in the journal Nature, in which he looks at the efficiency of various interstellar communications methods. And guess what he comes up with? He finds that the good old mail is the best communication medium. Welcome, Dr. Rose.
Hi, how are you?
Sending things by mail works better than all these fancy damn communication ideas?
Isn't that pretty amazing? It took us by surprise, and I guess we're kind of putting ourselves out of business. We do wireless, right? It is one of those really interesting sorts of things, and I fell into it kind of backwards, looking at wireless problems. And it turned out that if you want to deliver a lot of information and you're not too picky about when it gets there,
yeah,
meaning you don't have to get it there right away, it's often best to pack it into some sort of package, pack your information into some sort of package, and literally, just like you said, parcel post it, deliver it.
You mean, so when we put those on Voyager, on Pioneer, those discs and things like that with the symbols and the sounds, that was the best way of sending stuff out?
You know, obviously, there's all sorts of caveats. First off, I'm biased towards long messages, and the work, you know, is biased towards longish sort of messages. But once you do that, let's look at Voyager in particular. With that plaque, and you make some estimates about how much information it is, it's actually more efficient beyond 2,000 light years. And if we'd packed DVDs instead of the disc that was on there, it would be more efficient beyond 200 light years. So, yeah, it's completely counterintuitive until you actually think a little bit about it. But, yep, that's what it is.
But you're only covering such a tiny little space. I mean, the idea, if you radiate a light or radio wave goes out in all kinds of directions, you get more area coverage.
Yes, and that's another piece of this that is counterintuitive and why we were really excited about the result. The main point is that it's not onesies and twosies. It's twice as efficient or three times as efficient. It's many, many orders of magnitude more efficient from an energy use perspective to use what we call inscribed matter, so these parcel post sort of packages. So at Milky Way stellar densities, you'd have to have a galaxy about 10 times larger than the visible universe before it would be break even between inscribed matter, these parcel posts, and radiation. So it's huge numbers. And that's what buys you. You can send many parcels to the same place and still come out way ahead.
Give me an idea, because it is astounding. Is this just a mathematical construct, or because it doesn't intuitively make sense?
Yeah, here's the way I like to think about it, the primary way I like to think about it. First off, we all know Einstein equals MC squared, and if you try to accelerate things up to the speed of light, you have to use a whole lot of energy. And that's why people discounted space travel, and it's still true. There's no question about that. But when you're sending a message, you can afford to be slower, so you don't have to worry about that sort of stuff. Then the other key thing, and we'd see this in everyday life, imagine that we're standing right next to each other talking, and then one of us goes 100 yards away. Well, I got to scream louder to actually be heard by you that far away, because my voice disperses. Radio waves are exactly the same way, no matter how you cut it. That's the cute thing. It's a physical thing that you can't get around. Can't use a laser because that disperses too.
Yes, but if I wanted to send you a package there, I'd have to point it exactly in your direction.
That's another. Now, that's something we'd stray a little bit. Greg's an astrophysicist, but we don't do orbital mechanics and things like that, but that's kind of true. But what we're assuming is that things are going to be centered somewhere around a star somewhere. So that's a pretty big beacon in and of itself. So you could imagine sending things out and homing in particular planetary systems. By the way, the previous segment was wonderful news and interesting from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so what does that tell you about what method you would use to communicate with those new planets we're finding?
Well, see, communicate is one of those double-edged swords, and I only try to take the single edge, at least in this particular work. The times the round trip times, even if you use light, are so large. If you go 10,000 light years, it's 20,000 light years to get back, assuming they get the message the first time.
Right.
So maybe this notion of two-way is not really all it's cracked up to be. Maybe one of the things you might imagine is sending things out and leaving them there for posterity. The late Francis Crick had a cute idea, whether it's real or Memorex is unclear, because biological material tends to be fragile, but he posited seeding the stars with biological material on purpose. He called it directed panspermia. So I'm thinking more of one-way messages, and once you do that and you allow some delay, there's the math kind of speaks for itself.
And how much if you're the salesman and you're going door to door, how many encyclopedias do we have to send out there? Do we have to just saturate an area with them?
Now that's, again, you're getting close to, that's something we're working on. What we'd love to have been able to say is, here's what you should look for, or here's what you should send, and here's where you should place it. Because space is a big place. And the more stuff you send, the more energy you have to use to send it. So you want to send the minimum, but by the same token, you want to be able to find it. But the sorts of messages we considered in the paper are really large. You could imagine, as an example, and this is, you know, getting slightly silly, but it's large, all of the genomes of everybody on the planet and all the animals.
That's so pretty big.
It's big. but the break-even point for these a really smart journalist asked that question and actually did the calculation. Turns out, at least for the example that we did in the paper, something like the Library of Congress is about the break-even point where mass and radiation are about equally efficient.
Hmm. But you can now shrink that down into a little chip?
Yep, you can shrink that down pretty teensily.
Yeah.
In our version, it's probably on the size, on the order of a grain of sand, but even practically, well, I can't say practically. Nobody's tried it, but yeah. You can imagine it would be very small.
All right, now let's say somewhere, some intelligent life has decided, hey, you know, we figured this out a long time ago, that we could see the universe with little objects or a lot of, media-intense objects. Could they be not around us and we just not even see them here?
That could be. That's one of the most exciting and fun sort of aspects of this work. That opens up the possibility. Not only we usually think in terms of the contact, but you know there could be zillions of these things around. If there are millions of civilizations that have grown up and died or are still existing within our galaxy, you could imagine that there's lots of messages sitting out there. And that's really the next step. The hard part about this is figuring out what to look for and where to look for it. And that, we have some suggestions, but they're not really tight, clean, wonderful, you know, compelling suggestions just yet, or at least not as compelling as these efficiency numbers that we came up with.
So should we, if you're saying that all the DNA of all the people everywhere on the Earth would be the size, should we look for some sort of artifact here on the Earth that might contain that sort of thing?
Well, like, you know, once you open up the possibility that you're going to look for messages that are inscribed on something, there are all sorts of possibilities. One of my favorites, which is probably not really that great, is imagining something embedded in a comet. I mean, you talk about advertisement, this thing hurtling through the sky that lights up. But the reason it's probably not a great idea is that those things are not really that persistent. So that's a possibility, but, you know, who knows. Another one that is kind of cute, but again, complete speculation, you could imagine an impact crater, something embedded in a rock. That's the example we used in the paper, but something embedded in a rock that made a big hole. And you go look for it later, assuming that it hasn't broken down and all that other stuff. So again, you see I'm waffling back and forth about
to,
what...
Yeah, you need to talk to those Tunguska people who... That's that Russian team that went out.
Right, right, right.
A few months saying they found part of a spaceship out with it.
Yeah, that's, explain you know, that. Who knows?
So are you being taken seriously by your colleagues on this?
Well, the funny thing is that these ideas have been around a long time in the SETI community as well, and that's something that I'll count myself partially part of because, you know, I was never really interested specifically other than in kind of a science fiction-y sort of way with it. But the communications folks, we've long said that a really good communications channel, you could have one if you stuffed a truck full of tapes and discs and drove it across town. So that's something we kind of already knew intuitively. The difference here is that we actually quantified it, and it was even more compelling than we thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go now that you have this idea? I mean, can you make any practical use out of it?
Well, what Greg and I are doing, Greg is my co-author, what we're doing is we're trying to look for equally compelling physical reasons for where things should, what form the message should take, and where they should be placed. If we can come up with that, then we can begin to think about where to look. The SETI folks have been very generous and interested in the work. I spoke with Phil Morrison, e-spoke with Phil Morrison when I first recognized this stuff, and he's the grand old man of the area. Mm-hmm. His paper launched all of this stuff, and he was very encouraging and had some neat suggestions. I've heard in radio interviews Jill Tarter talking about it, and she's been absolutely wonderful. So everybody is, I think everybody recognizes that this is a possibility, but there are serious technical obstacles, and we need to look. Yeah. Just like Phil Morrison said 45 years ago, if you don't look, you're silly, essentially. But he didn't say silly. That's my ad lib.
Yeah. Phil might have a better frank exchange of views than that one. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Is it Dinah in Sun City?
Dina,
sorry.
Yes. You know, his information is so wonderful. I don't even know if this question is worth asking. But since it takes light travels so many miles in 1 year, light year is so long, and he said it took 30, the planet he saw was 30 light years away, I believe. Is he saying that what we're looking at is 60 years ago, and does he have any prediction as to what we might see in the next 60 years or 160 years in terms of other planets?
Now, what do you think?
You know, it's funny. That is something that would really be best directed at a professor who actually wrote a News and Views, a Counterpoint article in Nature, I think, Woody Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And what I understand of his work, and I could be misquoting, and he'll send me a rock if I am misquoting, was that a lot of our leakage radiation could be detectable.
Yeah.
As we go.
Well, Dan Wertheimer's coming on after you, so we'll ask him from SETI what he thinks what he thinks of this idea. And I guess there's it's an interesting idea, but as you say, you have to make a prediction about how to find these things if they're around us.
Exactly.
And search for them. And are the SETI people eager to do that?
Well, I don't really. The only person that I know who's an astrophysicist, we were part of the old Bell Labs diaspora at Crawford Hill.
Yes.
So, you know, where Telstar and I guess the biggest thing was Arno and Bob Wilson and the background radiation were discovered there. So we're all part of that in diaspora after divestiture. And so I don't really know the SETI folks, but I'm eager to find out because this is it's just such a neat problem and a neat area.
Let's go to Doreen in Hawaii. Hi, Doreen.
Aloha.
Aloha.
I had a couple of questions. One is, you know, about the crop circles. You know, that's a place where, you know, there's supposed to be all this mathematical information and codes in there. And there was a guy from a place, a website called CSETI, C-S-E-T-I, a guy named Stephen Greer talking about all kinds of things that just blow your mind as far as communication with these. I don't think that they communicate the way we think they communicate, you know, and I think that by us just assuming that they're communicating on radio waves or whatever is very naive. Another way I think that they may communicate, since they might be way more highly evolved, is to the spiritual, you know, we're basically spiritual beings. And maybe, like, there's telepathy and all that other kind of stuff out there with them. I don't know.
All right, Doreen.
Yeah, thank you.
Aloha.
Yeah, thank you.
Aloha.
You know, Doreen raised a number of interesting issues. The fact is you can speculate all over the place about stuff. What we've tried to do is avoid doing alien psychology because, you know, we're not too good at our own. So basically, there are a bunch of different modalities that you could imagine using for communication. Our particular pitch, and I really got to emphasize this, is really based on energy. And what we think of as if something requires much less energy to do than something else, then the easier thing is probably going to happen a little bit more. And that's a little bit of a motherhood issue, but that's really where we're coming down. So whatever modality you pick, you have to think about how much energy that you're going to use.
Yeah. We're talking about, we've run into all kinds of extraterrestrials, intelligent life in the outer space on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Is communicating... finding a common language or a common communication mode would seem to be a challenge.
Yeah, that's something, and again, this is stuff that the SETI community has dealt with for any number of years. My quick précis of that particular issue is you figure at least within the galaxy we share the same physics, so we kind of see the same things. So there's some commonality there.
But if you're sending out something, you know, in a physical form, don't you have to figure out what you're going to be sending?
Yes, of course. And just as the SETI folks imagine that you'd, if it were radio, there'd be particular forms it might take that don't look like natural artifact, natural objects out there, you'd probably, if you were trying to post something, it seems reasonable to try to make it look odd relative to things that you normally see in a solar system. So that, you know, almost goes without saying. You want your message to be found. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is finding it and or making it easy to find. But after that, then you got to set the cryptographers loose, because as far as actual communication, it was hard for us to figure out how to decode ancient languages without a Rosetta Stone. But, you know, cryptographers are pretty good at that sort of stuff. Mainly, you just got to get them some.
It reminds me, you know, that now that we're in this digital age, everything is encoded so heavily, 128-bit encryption, no one would be able to take it apart if we had, you know, it seems like the analog method of the old record play with the grooves on it is actually a better way of sending things out.
No, that is pretty interesting. It is nice physical. You can touch it. But again, going to your encryption note, you probably don't want to encrypt it. You want to make it. You want to make it so that it's as obvious as all get out. That you want to make your radio messages that way. You want to make your physical messages that way.
But if you came across a CD that we had, just a plain unencrypted CD, you'd have to figure out what the algorithm was for putting it on the CD.
Right. Right. Completely agreed. But the neat thing about information theory is that, assuming that you don't code things to encrypt it or really make it hard to find, there's going to be patterns that you can see. And once you see patterns, again.
Yeah.
And then the cryptographers.
Yeah. So you're now involved in trying to figure out the best way to encapsulate these things, or?
Yeah, there's a number of different things. One of the things is that you don't really, on Earth, you know, if you write down a letter and you toss it, as long as it doesn't get rained on, life is good.
Right.
But if you send a message through the stars, you have cosmic ray bombardment, and that can really tear up your message. So you have to worry about how to shield it, and that's something that we worried a little bit about. Basically, we put our message inside a big rock that would protect it. But there are other ways, so that's one thing. And it points to how do you figure out what form your message should take.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Christopher Rose, a professor of electrical and computer engineering, associate director of wireless network laboratories at Rutgers University in Piscataway, New Jersey. We're going to continue with our SETI mode. We started the ball rolling. We'll follow it up talking about what SETI is up to these days, get a little bit of its history, its search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where it's at, what's happening with the SETI at Home project, and some really weird stuff about a signal that came in at sort of got people scratching their head a bit. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the search for extraterrestrial life. We started talking about just the search for planets. Now we've moved on toward communicating with the extraterrestrial intelligent life. And we know there are other planets out there. Maybe there's a greater possibility some of them may have some sort of advanced civilization. So maybe it's not too much to think that we can communicate with them. And, you know, this methodical search for extraterrestrial life in outer space has been going on now for, what, over 40 years? Frank Drake had Project OSMA back in 1960, and then there was the first SETI conference in 1961, and there was actually another SETI conference a few weeks ago up in Cambridge. Joining me now is Dan Wertheimer. He's the project director of Serendip program and the chief scientist for the SETI at Home project. Maybe you have SETI at Home running on your own Mac or PC. He's based in the Space Sciences Lab at the University of California at Berkeley. But he's down in Arecibo, that giant telescope, the observatory in Puerto Rico. Welcome back to the program.
Pleased to be with you, Ira.
Have you got time down there on the...
Yeah, we're starting a big sky survey. Actually, it's a five-year program. We just started it this morning. We're really excited.
Oh, no. Okay. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the new thing here at the Arecibo Telescope, which is, you know, is the world's largest radio telescope. It's 1,000 feet across. It holds 10 billion bowls of cornflakes. You might have seen it in the... Contact movie or James Bond GoldenEye. So the new thing here is that instead of looking at one place in the sky at a time, we have a new receiver that can look at seven places in the sky at once. And that's like having seven Arecibo telescopes. So we're really excited. It makes it easier to map the sky survey. We can go seven times faster. We're going to be mapping the galaxy, also looking for extraterrestrials, trying to learn a little bit about cosmology. There are a lot of experiments that we're going to be doing simultaneously, and we're just starting out today.
Now, there was a whole gathering of the faithful, wasn't there, in Cambridge a few weeks ago?
Yeah, we had all the hot shots from the SETI community. We're not the only people doing SETI at Berkeley. There's a number of good groups around the world that are looking for different kinds of signals and trying different strategies, and I'm really happy about that. I think the right strategy is a multiple strategy. It would be naive to think that we know exactly what to look for, and we're looking for optical signals and radio signals and infrared, and a few people have done this, searching for kind of probes and messages and bottles that you were just talking about, I think the right thing to do. We have six different things we're trying at Berkeley.
And of course, you've got 5 million people have the little SETI at home running on their home PCs.
That's right. That's one of our six different SETI programs. SETI at home is by far the most well known program because we're asking the public for help. So we record the data here at the Arecibo Telescope, but instead of trying to analyze it here, we are sending it out to the 5 million volunteers around the world. They're in 226 countries who are running the SETI Home Screensaver program. Everybody gets assigned a different part of the sky to analyze. And combined, those volunteers have built the world's largest supercomputer and made the search a lot more powerful and sensitive. We're really grateful to all the people who are helping us analyze this data.
How do you deal with the fact that you haven't found anything yet? Does it get frustrating?
No, actually, I've been doing this for 30 years, and we haven't bagged the ET, of course, but I'm optimistic in the long run. I think I'm not doing the same thing I was doing 30 years ago. The technology changes so fast. We used to listen to 100 channels. Now we listen to 100 million channels. The people that are helping us with the SETI at Home program keep upgrading their PCs. Right now they're averaging 100 trillion calculations every second. They donate 1,000 years of computing time every day. That's spectacular compared to what we were doing even just a few years ago. So the reason that I'm optimistic is because the technology doubles every year. And so we're not doing the same thing we were doing 30 years ago. And actually, I think we're just getting in the game. We'd be really lucky to find them right now. Even though I'm really proud of what we're doing, we're just looking at a little part of the radio spectrum. We can't do a thorough search. We can't look at every place in the sky at all the different frequencies and all the different patterns. But if you look at the progress that we've made and other groups have made, we need another factor of a million or a billion to go, but that's only 20 or 30 years. So if there are other civilizations out there, I think, don't hold your breath, but it might be in our lifetimes.
Are you encouraged by the discovery of these new planetoids, these new Earth-like planets?
That's spectacular. Because so far we've known about these big gas giant planets,
right.
Jupiter and Neptune, but we think that it's much more probable for life to get started on a dinky planet like Earth, a rocky planet. And we thought there were lots of rocky planets out there, but we really didn't know. And now we know there are rocky planets out there, and so there are good sites for life. And so that's even more driving force to think that the universe is teeming with life, and it would be bizarre to think that we're the only ones.
Mm-hmm. And what about this flap that occurred just a few days ago about a recent article in New Scientist magazine saying that some of your SETI at home people had discovered some interesting, there was one signal that stood out from the rest of 1,000 light years away.
Well, I wish I could say we found something interesting, but unfortunately that was sensationalist hype, and we don't have anything unusual. We've had these kind of candidate signals for the last 30 years, and this one is not any different from the last one. They've always turned out to be noise or interference. So we keep following up on these things, but so far mm-hmm. none of them have panned out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Jill Tarter. I think she is the scientist who supposedly is sort of a fictionalized. She's been fictionalized in Contact, correct? In the movie,
Carl Sagan wrote the book Contact, and in the Contact movie, there is a female scientist who does SETI, and Jill is a female scientist who does SETI. There are not that many women in SETI, and so there are a lot of parallels. We don't know exactly what Carl was thinking, but he unfortunately died too young. He's a spectacular guy and just done fabulous contributions to educating the public and to science. Jill is a good model.
Mm-hmm. People ask all the time, how will you know when you find? communication from outer space. What do you look for, and how do you weed through all the noise and other things that are out there?
So it's very much like tuning your radio across the dial. So you're moving the knob across the dial, and you're looking at the power meter on your dial, if you have one of those power meters on your radio. And you, as you tune across, you hear mostly static. And then as you're tuning across, maybe the power meter goes up, and it says, hey, there's something there. Maybe, we don't know what it is, but that's the first kind of thing that tells us there's something at one of these frequencies. We don't know what frequency. That's why we have to move across the radio dial. And actually, we're listening now to 100 million different frequencies, and that's what gets our attention. And, of course, the next thing is, when you come back to that place in the sky, do you see the same thing again? Does it repeat? Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is, if we get really excited about that, and we've seen it many times, we will ask a different group with a different telescope and different software to see if they can see it, and we can triangulate on it, make sure it's not like a satellite or something like that.
Right.
And we need a different group because it may be a bug in our software, a graduate student trying to play a prank on us. So we need independent confirmation, and then we'll make an announcement to the whole community. All information will be shared to the public and the scientific community.
Mm. Okay. Angela and Corvallis, you're on Science Friday. Welcome.
There. I do study at home, and it's a lot of fun, but I was wondering, up at your level, I guess a higher administrative level, is there anybody who's ever voiced hesitations that some sort of alien life might not be at all friendly to us? In respect that, you know, SETI seems sort of scanning, but in the other instance where we're sending out information, could they perhaps use that to track back, you know, where our planet is, et cetera, et cetera? All sorts of doomsday, you know. I grew up watching V, so.
Are you watching Predator versus Alien now? Is that
what?
Watching the movie Predator versus Alien?
No, I read the book, but I didn't see the movie.
Sorry, just free association. I'm sorry. Dr. Wertheimer, any?
So, Angela, of course, the SETI community is listening. We're doing a passive experiment. We're not sending messages out into space. But other people are, and you should be careful what you say on this radio station, because the radio signals from Science Friday go out into the atmosphere, traveling out at the speed of light, and have reached thousands of stars. I Love Lucy and Ed Sullivan have reached thousands of stars. So the Earth has been transmitting for a long time, and there may be other civilizations out there who are been watching our television or trying to decode our messages. So Earth is transmitting, but I think right now the SETI people should just be listening. Now, so your question is it dangerous there? We don't really know what other civilizations are like. There may be very advanced civilizations out there a billion years ahead of us, because our star is 5 billion years old, but some stars are 10 billion years old. So you can imagine civilizations that are far more advanced than we are, and we hope they're benevolent. My guess is that we're in this kind of infancy stage where we're still killing each other, and civilizations that kill each other don't last very long, and the ones that do survive are – but we don't know that. And I think there's a danger – of maybe even just contacting these civilizations if they send information to you, and that information contains a lot of technological information. Of course, that may be wonderful. You can cure a lot of diseases, but you can also use that kind of information to do terrible things if the militaries of the world use it to kill each other. So we do have to be careful, as with any kind of technological information, to make sure we put it to good use.
I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about SETI this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. What is the possibility that we could be so primitive that we can't even, you know, detect the signals from a very advanced civilization? We don't even know what they are.
Yeah, I think it'd be naive to think that we know exactly what advanced civilizations are going to do. And if you'd asked me 100 years ago what to look for, I might have said smoke signals. So we've only had radio 100 years. We think right now electromagnetic communication is probably the best bet, and that's where we're putting most of our effort, in the visible and the infrared and the radio. We're putting smaller bets on the stuff you were just talking about, messages in the bottle. I think that's a little more unlikely, but I don't think that we should rule it out, and I think I would encourage people to search at the Lagrangian points and other places where other civilizations may put these probes. We can't guarantee that they're going to be sending us electromagnetic radiation, but I think it's our best bet. We know that Earthlings are capable of sending messages across the galaxy with even the primitive technology we have today. There's a transmitter here at the telescope that can send messages 100,000 light years away. So I think that's our best bet, but I wouldn't rule out that in the future we'll learn some more physics and we'll learn how to do it better.
George in Ann Arbor. Hi, George.
Yes, hello. I have a few simple and quick questions that have been bugging me for years, and this is an opportunity to quickly find out the answer.
Quickly.
Okay. Does the SETI program assume that these aliens want to be found? Does it assume that these messages are continuously broadcast? What about a message designed to go on a one-time basis from point A to point B, where point B is not Earth? Would we find such a message with this program?
So, George, there are two kinds of things you can imagine coming from a distant civilization, as you just pointed out in your question. One is a leakage kind of signal that's not intended for communication to us. It's their television or radar signal, a navigational beacon, something that they're using internally for their own purposes that goes off their planet, leaks into space, and we intercept it.
Okay.
So that's one way to find them. Another thing would be that they've been watching us, they've seen smog in our atmosphere, they know a little bit about us, and they've been watching our television maybe, or they just don't know much about us, but they send us a signal on purpose. Now, that might contain a huge amount of information, all their music, science, poetry, literature, how to get on the galactic internet. Maybe they've been talking to a million other civilizations. So we'd be happy, of course, with either kind of signal, an artifact or of their technology or a deliberate signal. My guess is that if we ever find radio signals or laser signals or something from ET, it's probably going to be an artifact of their technology. Mm-hmm. It won't be somebody beaming a signal deliberately, because I think we're too young. We're just learning how to do this, and my guess is that they're going to wait a little while. Mm-hmm. If you watch Star Trek, you know about the Prime Directive.
Right, but, George, thanks for calling.
Yeah, but a one-time message from point A to point B, where point B is nowhere near Earth, would that still be spotted by SETI?
It's unlikely, because we only point our telescope to a particular place in the sky for 10 or 20 seconds. So if the signal's only on for a little bit, the chance that we're pointing to that place in the sky during their broadcast, the chances are that we're going to miss it. Mm. So that's kind of the limits of our technology right now, is that we have to scan one place in the sky at a time. That'll change in the next 20 or 30 years. We'll be able to look at lots of places in the sky simultaneously.
Well, good luck to you, Dan. I'll give you 10 seconds to tell me if you had a blank check what you need to make this work.
To find ET? So the good news is that it's happening kind of as we speak. There are a number of good groups looking
for... 10 seconds, Dan. What do you need?
Money.
Why am I not surprised? All right. Thanks for taking time to talk with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dan Wertheimer is a project director for the Serendip Program, and he is the chief scientist for the SETI at Home project. He's based in the Space Sciences Lab, University of California at Berkeley. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kima Leskey and Alphonse Finn. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can leave us email at our website at sciencefriday.com. Also, you can listen to back editions of Science Friday. Take them on your iPod and your audible.com format. Have a great weekend. Have a good holiday. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.